So let's talk. This is Dune, and I don't know why, but this became one of our most contentious episodes ever. So I guess enjoy that part. Personally, I didn't get it. I know that how that sounds, but man, nothing happens. It looks cool, but nothing happens. Anyway, if you're listening to this when it comes out, which should be Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving. I assume you're listening because you might have a long drive, or you, I don't know, maybe you don't have something fun to do today. So thanks for sharing your time with me, and get yourself a nice sandwich. Do something nice for yourself, because that's important. Plugs. The first Thursday of December, which is the 7th, I am doing a Cineprov show in Atlanta, so you should do it. And because it's cheesy, I am thankful for you guys. I really do appreciate the fact that we've grown substantially since we came back to weekly episodes in July. And frankly, it makes it great. I'm really happy that we are back at full force and you guys appreciate it. Please give us a review. And welcome to the food holiday time of year. I'm really excited. I do like a good food holiday. Thanks.
Hey guys, are you looking for a new podcast to listen to? Something a little on the geeky side, but lots and lots of fun with some crazy dudes? Well, if I got something for you, it's called the Vitamin Geek Podcast. I'm the host, Corey Keelan, and I'm here with my friends, Eric Williams.
What's up?
Patrick Sykes.
Greetings, everyone.
And Michael Zippy Miller.
Hey there.
We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. Horror movies, science fiction. We love Star Wars. Who doesn't love Star Wars? If you don't like Star Wars, get the hell off of here. Check us out, man. Vitamin Geek Podcast right here on the ESO Network.
It's all part of the plan.
Welcome to Miami Defend Your Childhood. This week, we decided to sing a musical number rather than talk about the movie we watched, which was David Lynch's 1984 Frank Herbert adaptation of Dune. I'm Nick Hoffman, editor-in-chief of Dude Letter and host of Miami Defend Your Childhood, Doom to Repeat, and Riffer on Cineprov. And on panel, we have...
I'm Matthew W. Quinn, author of the teen horror novel The Thing in the Woods and a bunch of sci-fi stuff, all available on Amazon.
This is Daniel. I got nothing.
All right. I apologize for that static. Matt started talking much louder all of a sudden, and I had to fix it. God damn, this movie was awful. So, okay, before we get into this, at the end, there's going to be a fourth voice. Regular contributor Aaron, who's a co-host with me, I guess under host Scott on Myopia Mornings, really, really wanted to talk about this movie. It was one of her favorites. We love you, Aaron. You're wrong.
She has a huge crush on Kyle MacLachlan. It's incredible to hear.
Well, what about Sting? He at one point runs around in a steel Speedo for no reason at all.
Well, he was supposed to be naked, apparently, but then the censors said, no, you can't do that. So that was their compromise.
I mean, he looks good. I think MacLachlan looks better, which, I mean, fine. He's also an actor. Sting is not an actor. As we see with the two lines he delivers.
I will kill him. I will kill him.
Yeah, those are the two.
And you deliver them about as well as he did,
and frankly. And he's openly perving on Channy, too.
Well, that was probably just not even scripted. That's just what happened.
At that point, he was practicing tantric acting, where he doesn't do any acting for 12 hours, and then he explodes in acting all over your screen. Okay, so for those of you who have not seen this movie, you're right. And that's about it. Daniel, would you like to give us a synopsis? I'm sorry, go. Give me a plot. Here, wait, let me help.
Okay, so it's like a little after the year 10,000. I think it was like 10,191. In the year 2929.
We're making different cultural allusions.
Okay, yeah, but so there's this huge galaxy-spanning Game of Thrones-esque fight going on between the House Harkonnen and the House Atreides.
Atreides.
Atreides, yes, thank you, Matt. And in order to resolve it, the Emperor of the Galaxy gives the desert planet Arrakis, gives control of that planet to the Atreides, but apparently it's a double cross between the Emperor and the House Harkonnen. And so that goes wrong. But at the same time, there's this group of people on the planet called the Fremen who help the survivors of the House Atreides to take their revenge against the Harkonnens after the Harkonnens invade the planet and killed Duke Atreides. And I know, Nick, I know, I'm sorry, but that's what happens in the movie.
I dropped a Duke Atreides halfway through this movie.
I'm so sorry. I heard the yelling. Am I wrong, Matt? Is that what happens in the movie? Or feel free to pick it up.
Yeah, the book and the Sci-Fi Channel original miniseries that came on when I was in high school both explain this whole situation far, far better.
So is that it? I mean, did Daniel get it right then, I guess?
Essentially.
Okay, so
it's like space feudalism.
There's also some sort of religion that the Fremen have where they're waiting for their Messiah, and the son of the House Atreides might be the person to fulfill that prophecy. And Nick, I need whiskey. Do you have whiskey?
I do have whiskey, but you have to earn it. It's over there.
Yeah.
You have to ride the worm to earn the whiskey.
It.
Huh. So Brad Dourif's in it, and he's Worm Tongue. It's full circle.
Aww.
His eyebrows got progressively smaller and smaller until he didn't have any at all as Worm Tongue.
Oh, Jesus. He was in Heaven's Gate. He was in this movie. What is Brad Dourif? How does he survive all these things?
He was in the new Halloween movie. The 2007.
Yes, he was. He was actually very good in it. He was the sheriff.
Let's back up. He's good in everything. He's just not in good projects. I mean, I guess he could be good as Chucky. Chucky's a terrible character, but he brings.
Oh, shit. he was a good Chucky.
That must be why how he survives is he has residuals from every Child's Play movie.
Well, he was an Oscar nominee for
his first movie.
Yeah,
Cuckoo's Nest.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah, he got nominated for an Oscar. And I love you, Brad Dourif.
You're better choices.
Yeah, you're a great character actor, but please, man, come on.
Oh, wow. In the year he was in Heaven's Gate, he was in The Story of Jim Jones.
Oh.
A little redundant, don't you think?
I'm not going to argue with you, but he was.
Heaven's Gate was not about the cult. It was a Western about...
That the cult gets its name from later on, right?
Yeah, well, I think so.
He was also in The Exorcist 3, which is what... Dahmer would watch when he was killing people. So it's even more full circle.
I thought Heaven's Gate did it have a cult following, or was the director like really overbearing and domineering and treat everyone like his slaves?
Is yes.
That went wrong?
Yes.
And the latter.
He was crazy. He actually died last year, I think. He was one of the people that 2016 took away.
Yeah, and then Heaven's Gate were the people who dressed all the same and then killed themselves. And then,
yeah.
When Hale Bopp Comet came along.
Yeah.
Ugh, gross. Cult people are gross. That's why I can't be a Unitarian. But let's talk about Dune.
Desert Planet Dune, Arrakis Dune.
God, this movie's so bad. So... Like, all right, we can't even go through it.
Do you mind if I set up the background behind it? Do you care?
Go.
Okay, fine. So this was a David Lynch movie. And before this, David Lynch had already gained a cult following with Eraserhead, right? That was a huge midnight movie back in the day that midnight movies meant something. So he got hired by Mel Brooks to do The Elephant Man, which got nominated for 8 Oscars. So they figured, oh, hey, this kid's going somewhere. So Dino De Laurentiis hired him to do this huge sci-fi epic he had the rights to. And this was right after the first two Star Wars movies. Actually, all three of them had come out by this point, but it was in development when the Star Wars movies were getting made. So they figured, oh, this will be David Lynch's big mainstream break. And it didn't work out that way at all.
Well, and further, of course, there's a 1960s movie that was in the works that failed.
Oh, the Yudorowski version.
Which there's an actually a very good documentary on.
Oh.
which would have been a better movie. And in case you're curious if this is going to be a good movie, in German, they translated it as Diverst Planet. And Diverst Planet is a perfect way to describe this.
Well, I saw the Yerderowski documentary at UA Terra for the people that are in Atlanta. So that's an amazing thing. And it was, again, for background, because we don't care about the actual movie, Yerderowski was another midnight movie director who made these.
El Topo.
Yeah, El Topo and the Holy Mountain.
Holy Mountain.
And he was going to direct a version of Dune in the mid-70s, and it would have been so much better, but he had written it, and they had storyboarded it and cast it, but when he actually was pitching it, everybody told him no because it would have been too expensive. But it would have been so much better because...
yeah, I'm assuming it wouldn't start out with a random floating head.
Well... It would have
doing
been
a voiceover.
It would have been a like pan in to a specific planet. Like it would have started at the top of the Milky Way galaxy, and they explained this in the documentary, and just kept panning into the specific planet.
That would have been better than Princess Uralan, who's doing this voiceover narrative. Did you say it was like Sardoz?
Yeah, pretty much, because it's the floating head in the future trying to explain what the hell's going on to the people that have no idea.
And then she fades out and is like, wait a minute, and fades back in again.
Oh, that was terrible.
She forgets her dialogue halfway through.
Virginia Madsen, by the way, that's who that was.
Mildly successful actress, Virginia Madsen.
She was in that movie version of Prairie Home Companion, wasn't she? She was in Altman.
She was also in Sideways in number 23, and I think in Candyman.
Oh, she was in Candyman? Well, that's her career-defining moment right there.
She's in a movie called 1985 coming out in 2018, so nailed it.
Oh, boy.
It's like that 2012 movie that came out in 2009. You're just like, you know, you could have waited. No one's going to watch it anyway. Who's a buzz? And then after we plan into the floating head of Who Gives a Shit, we then have...
The floating head. That's going to be an album title if I ever make an album. The floating head of Who Gives a Shit.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure Dane Cook already has a whole bunch of Who Gives a Shit. And then we go to a dialogue between three people who we haven't met yet. And it's all exposition. It's like, it's nothing.
Mm-hmm. What was that exposition again? The throne room.
And then it's setting up exposition about the trade and about the spice and the who could possibly...
Well, again, I think, what was it? The Harkonnens control Arrakis, but nominally the Emperor gives it to the Atreides house, and who gives a shit?
They're setting up the Atreides for a fall, basically.
Basically, yes.
Okay, here's the problem. We don't know these people yet, and so they're thinking, well, let's explain everything. Problem is, we don't care. We just don't care. That's why in Star Wars, when they start out, it's the rebels versus the Empire. They explain little races and crap later, and it's slow drip, and then, oh, he's a Wookiee. What's a Wookiee? That's a Wookiee. We don't have to know. Yeah. We don't have to know that, like, who could possibly
care?
That's a
good point, because the whole thing is that they built Paul Atreides up to be this messiah, right?
Yep.
And by that point, it's too little too late. I mean...
Well, at one point, like an hour and 30 minutes into the movie, I look over at Daniel and it suddenly became a movie because he had an army. He mattered. This is Kyle MacLachlan's
character. Last half hour of the movie.
And there's Patrick Stewart, who has a mullet as much as he can have a mullet when 3/4 of his hair is gone.
We forget that most of the movie is told in whispers because that's the internal dialogue of the people.
Oh, that's right. And that sucks so bad.
I'm getting a raging ASMR erection right now.
There's so many whispers in this movie.
And the subtitles all say in her voice and don't say what they're saying.
They're whispering. They're not saying anything because it's meant to be a mind link. And who could give a fuck?
And Matt's right. They are not saying anything that matters to anything. We have a fat guy who's getting Brazil-style plastic surgery the whole time called the Baron.
Baron Harkonnen.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, well, that is him, but... You know, I'll just go ahead and say this because you know what? That was the entire thing I was thinking about during this movie is Baron Harkonnen in the Yerderowski version would have been Orson Welles.
Would he have eaten a planet?
Yes. Well, like in the documentary, Yordorowski talks about actually meeting him, and the whole thing was that they knew he was in Paris, so they scoped out like every restaurant in Paris until they found out where he was. And when they got here, he was like, he had ordered everything on the menu, and he was like drinking 6 bottles of wine and stuff like that. So when they went over to see him, originally Orson Welles said, "I'm not going to do it." And then after the fact, Yordorowski said, "Well, you know what? If you do it, I'll hire the chef of this restaurant who will prepare your meals on set for my movie." And then Orson Welles is like, "Okay, yeah, I'll do it."
Orson Welles is just a fat man at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Filled with frozen penis.
That's not wrong.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
There's a famous commercial you need to listen to of him like, "Who wrote this?"
Oh, the Paul Masson wine, right?
Yeah. Where it's just like he's just insulting the person who wrote it, who directed it. "I will show up to set when I feel like showing up."
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's what, what's his name, does. Maurice LaMarche, whenever he's warming up to do the brain voice.
Yes, full of country goodness and green penis.
Who wrote this? This is terrible.
I quit. I can't do Orson Welles. I'm not even.
I'll just
try.
Take a few for the road.
I think of Orson Welles, just think of Unicron.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's what he was at this point.
I was going to say, this is the point in the career when any talent he had is long gone.
Well, he would like take on the stupidest roles imaginable to try and finance his films, but he'd never finish them. So it was like this really bad cycle that he was in.
Well, and like the closest he ever got, like something like the Amazing Ambersons, the studio
Magnificent Ambersons,
yes, would be torn apart by the studios and would never see the light of day in the version he wanted. So he wanted to finance his own stuff, but he could never say no to anything. And so these movies would be towering epics that he would either run out of money or interest in, that we'd have these unfinished cuts that were 6 hours long.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which is what this feels like.
Well, Netflix is supposed to bring out a like lost Orson Welles movie, and we're talking about Orson Welles because that's so much better than this movie. They're supposed to bring out one of his lost movies next year or so.
Well, hopefully they found a script of the Ambersons or something.
Well, they have. Who played Baron Harkonnen in this one? Because McMillan. He's probably as big as Orson Welles.
Kenneth MacMillan? Oh, no, he was not.
No.
He's like half the size of Orson Welles at this point.
Wow. There's a set photo of him from the Yordorowski video, and it's just, that's a large man.
Yeah.
Kenneth MacMillan, for those of you who don't know, was also in Amadeus. And who
was he in Amadeus?
Schlumberg.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was in Runaway Train and in Cat's Eye. All of the movies he's known for took place between 84 and 85.
Is he still alive?
No, he died.
When did he die?
89. At the age of 56 for being fat.
I might explain why all his roles were in the 80s.
We already said who else is in this movie, and that's Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart.
And everyone carries around pugs for some reason, including Patrick Stewart.
Well, and that glorious bald mullet that Patrick Stewart has.
Brad Dourif's in this too. Freddie Jones is in this. I mean, I don't even know what you want to talk about. Like the first literally 90 minutes of this movie, nothing happens. It's a bunch of exposition to let us know effectively that there's this thing called spice, which is a hallucinogenic thing that allows people to travel through space and time. Oh,
melange, I believe it is. And it's supposed to be, what is it? Something like the fuel that fuels rocket ships or something?
Yeah, basically, this is something they left out of the movie. There, at some point in the past, there was a war between humans and thinking machines in which the humans won. And so they banned all higher level computers. So in order to have successful space folding technology faster than light, you would need very high level computers, but they don't want those. So if you get someone high on spice melange long enough, they'll mutate into some giant fish critter that has the brain power to calculate faster than light space travel jumps.
I'll take Matt's word for it. I mean,
it's basically a dolphin turd in a punch bowl.
Yeah. Well, they show like at the opening of this movie, it's the face of Bo from Doctor Who talking to Jose Ferrer.
So let's talk about this movie. This is made by.
Let's not.
Well, no. Let's do this. So David Lynch is a directing legend, right? Twin Peaks just came back out this year. It's a masterpiece. The original Elephant Man is a masterpiece. Blue Velvet is a masterpiece. I even really.
Mulholland Drive is a masterpiece. The Straight Story is a masterpiece.
And he made this. And I'm going to quote IMDb because, of course, it's science. David Lynch has said he considers this the only real failure of his career.
He's right.
To this day, he refuses to talk about the production in great detail and refused numerous offers to work on a special edition DVD or to do a director's commentary. Lynch claims revisiting the film would be too painful of an experience to endure. David Lynch turned down the chance to direct Star Wars Episode VI, Return of the Jedi, to direct the film, telling George Lucas, "It's your thing. It's not my thing."
Well, he's not wrong in regards to Star Wars, but he's also not wrong in regards to this is the only big failure of his career. I mean, Jesus.
The original director, Ridley Scott, left production.
No, yeah. The original director was, Jesus, how did you, DeLaurentiis get the rights to this? Because originally it was up in the air when Yudorowski was pitching it, right?
Yeah, I think the production company went out of business and he was able to buy it off of the bankrupt production company.
Ah, there you go.
Dune would take too long and he decided to do Blade Runner instead, which was also a flop, but that is a masterpiece.
Well, the sequel is a flop too, which is heartbreaking. But yeah, I mean, that's how like Ridley Scott met a lot of the people that helped make Blade Runner. Like H.R. Geiger was supposed to do the original Dune movie that Yudorowski was doing, and Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien that Ridley Scott directed, wrote the original script and did the special effects for Dune as well, or he was hired to do so. So, man, I'm just so obsessed with how Yudorowski's version would have turned out.
Patrick Stewart said the still suit was the most uncomfortable costume he had ever worn. Max von Sydow said the same thing, but put up with it because he loved the way his body looked in them.
Oh, well, how can you argue with that? I mean, come on.
This is so great. David Lynch in 2006. Dune, I didn't have the final cut on Dune. It's the only film I made where I didn't have it. I didn't technically have it on Elephant Man, but Mel Brooks gave it to me anyway, and on the Dune film, I started selling out. Even on the script phase, I didn't have a final cut, and I sold out. So it was a slow, dying, the terrible, terrible death. A terrible, horrible experience. I don't know how it happened. I trusted that it would work out, but I was naive, and, well, it was the wrong move.
Terrible death. It sounds like watching this movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
In those days, the maximum length they could think of was 2 hours and 17 minutes, and that's how long the film was.
It's not so much a death so much as it is a reinvention of life.
And I'm going to stop doing that whisper thing because that's annoying as hell. You know how this movie is.
It sounds like a Bergman film kind of thing.
Pretty much.
But without the artistic.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny. The stuff is really bad. It's so putrefied. Oh, and by the way, in case you're curious, it's not even a Dino De Laurentiis. It's his ex-wife, Rafaela De Laurentiis.
Oh, there you go.
This is so bad. Rafaela De Laurentiis is the mother of...
Giada, right?
Giada. Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, this is bad, man. Oh, that's funny. She is also the producer of Conan the Barbarian and Dragonheart. Stay tuned. So, what else do we've got?
Well, I mean, this was Kyle MacLachlan's first movie, which is why I know Aaron likes this so much, because she's a huge Kyle MacLachlan fan. And he was the guy that was in Blue Velvet, and he's Dale Cooper on Twin Peaks.
And the mayor in Portlandia.
Yeah. He's a great actor, and he really does capture, when he's cast in the right role, that sort of quirky everyman sort of thing. But here, the whole problem with this movie is that it's really meant to be this grand, ambitious, religious sort of text, and that's how the novel plays, and I'm sure Matt will agree with me on that.
Yeah, it's like Paul is Jesus or Muhammad or something. Like, I'm thinking more like Muhammad because he's the one who unites all the desert tribes and conquers the universe.
Right, exactly. Well, it's a religious text, but at the same time, Lynch doesn't really go, when he ever does a movie, he doesn't really look at the religious aspect of anything. It's all about existentialism and one man's experience, which is why this doesn't work at all.
And so many hallucinations.
And that's the whole thing about Kyle McLaughlin's character. He's trying to pretend like he's a messiah, but it just doesn't work.
Well, I mean, it is two parts. It's also the I mean, you're saying Jesus, and Jesus is fine. You know, Jesus is just all right with me. But I was going to go further and say it's more of Neo from the Matrix, because he doesn't know he's the messiah and becomes the messiah, right? It's that kind of thing. He discovers who he is. Problem is, in a braver movie, it's the same reason that Blade Runner had problems, right? It's narration after exposition after narration. Mm-hmm. Let us figure it the fuck out. This movie treats us like children. Everyone's telling us everything the whole time. This must have had 1,000 pages of script dialogue.
Whoa.
And none of it matters.
No. Well, I mean, the only reason I knew what was happening was because I had read the novel back when I was in high school.
But did it make any difference in this thing? It doesn't. At one point, he's riding a giant fucking worm like he's a bull rider.
I'm going to defer to Matt, because I think he knows more about this aspect of it.
Yeah, that's part of like the Fremen culture and way of warfare, is they've learned how to harness the sandworms. Imagine like a quarter mile long monster worm that eats everything.
That'd be great if we saw any of it. At the end, it's just a gaping maw that shit flies into.
It looks like a Demogorgon from Stranger Things.
Or the Sarlacc, like the rings of teeth.
Yeah.
It's all crap. It makes no sense. This is a trite movie.
We did learn one important thing about this movie, which also was a great part of our childhoods, which is if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm.
Oh, my God. When he said that, if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm. And we all started laughing.
If you walk without rhythm, you'll never learn.
So when I was watching this, I posted on my Facebook, the first thing that we learned is that the soundtrack is done by Brian Eno, but most of the soundtrack is done by the band Toto, known for forgetting about the rains in Africa. But Sting is in this, and there's no songs by Sting or the Police.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is baffling. And the first comment on this, oh, my God, this movie is a travesty, which it is. This movie is, I honestly don't see what people see in it.
Well, the whole thing, too, the most famous aspect of this movie was the bit with Sting and the Speedo, right? But I don't even remember the context behind that. It was like right after the Baron had killed everybody and Sting was like in a sauna or something.
They're setting up that Raban, the older, dumber nephew, would misrule and abuse the people in Arrakis, and then Fade Rautha would come in to save them and kill Raban, and somehow that would lead to Fade Rautha marrying the Imperial Princess and getting Harkonnen on the Imperial throne.
Okay.
In the book, at least.
Okay, Matt was completely accurate in his description, so this isn't a slam against him. That makes no goddamn sense.
Well, and if you rewind...
It's from Machiavelli, the...
I know, but I don't care because this movie doesn't really care.
Well, and I was going to say...
Fair enough.
If you rewind about a minute, you can hear Matt sighing midway through his sentence.
Yeah, pretty much. Matt's our resident Garrison Keillor. He'll like sigh through these long, drawn-out stories.
I mean, he's right. This is unnecessary. All of this is garbage.
It should have been a TV series.
Which it was in 2000 that had no budget and flopped.
I just remember in the documentary that Yoderowski, when he was making his script, he even said, I want this to be a 12-hour movie, and that's why everybody kept turning him down. But it's like, that makes more sense.
Yeah, that just wasn't done back then.
Or really even today, but it could probably... Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, you're not wrong. It's just the Hobbit exists, so you can't ever say that again.
Yeah, that's true.
We've been talking long enough, because who could be bothered?
How long have we been talking?
35 minutes, but I think we're cutting some of it, so Whatever.
Well, I've actually got another thing to...
Please.
Okay. The cast was actually good, especially if you're a Lynch fan. I mean, he puts a lot of his regular people, including Everett McGill, who was Big Ed Hurley in Twin Peaks. So it was kind of fun seeing that. And Jack Nance was in this movie. And David Lynch himself was in this movie. He was one of the spice mining foremen. But I don't know. It was kind of just like a little Easter egg that doesn't really mean anything, because it, at this point, they hadn't been established as like Lynch players except for Jack Nance.
Well, and, you know, Patrick Stewart is in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Max von Sydow and a lot of actors who...
Jose Ferrer was in, was the Emperor.
But they just don't matter. Nothing in this movie seems like it matters.
I would have so loved to actually see Salvador Dali as the Emperor, which is what Yudorowski wanted to do, and Dali agreed to do it. So, man.
Yeah. Okay, so I was going to ask, so is there anything we did like about this movie? You seemed to like the casting.
Well, I mean... The only elements that I really appreciated were the ones that I recognized from what Yudorowski wanted to do, because they were carried over into this. But Lynch was just not the right guy to do it. So every time, and I'm a huge Lynch fanboy, but every time I saw that, it's like, man, you can do better.
Well, I mean, like, and again, if this was filmed in 68, the effects look fine, but it's not. It's filmed in 1982 or so.
Yeah.
And we've had a lot of big budget movies that look better than this. Like, there was clearly money here. It's just wasted on stupid things.
Yeah. That was weird about the effects, because I was kind of trying to picture myself in the 80s audience, where, you know, green screen was still a thing and where computer effects were still brand new, which is what the Shields were, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, very bad.
Very basic, but I mean, back in the day, I'm sure it would have looked fantastic.
But I mean, like, this is after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, yeah.
Return of the Jedi is already, like, and so, like, that throws out the window, because the original Return of the Jedi coming out in 83, mm-hmm. right? And Tron is 82.
Yeah.
I mean, like, all this stuff is dated and it just feels like crap. And like, when he's riding the snake, you can see the line from the green screen in the background. And we were watching it on DVD and not a Blu-ray. And we can see this on a Blu-ray. I'm sure it just looks like complete gargle mess.
So much matte painting in this movie, too. Like, when you see the stuff in space.
There are talented people who can use matte paintings, but this...
Clearly matte painting, like Matt was saying. It's just clear in the background. You could...
Yeah, I have a feeling a lot of this was due to the De Laurentiis restrictions, because I know that David Lynch can use special effects to a good cause. I mean, the Elephant Man had gotten 8 Oscar nominations. It had almost gotten a special award for its makeup. Back in the day, best makeup wasn't a thing at the Oscars yet. That might come up later if we ever do the Elephant Man. But...
Classic childhood movie, The Elephant Man.
No, when I was a like real little kid back in Virginia, my like next door neighbor who is the same age as me, and I was like 5, that was her favorite movie, was The Elephant Man.
Fair. I mean, I don't know how to argue with that, but she was a serial killer now, I guess.
I have no idea. I don't think so, but...
I mean, I guess she wouldn't tell you, hey, Daniel, it's been great. It's been a while. I'm a serial killer now.
Oh. It's been 23 years. I've killed 13 people. How are you doing?
Bit of a dry spell.
But I mean, yeah, David Lynch knows what he's doing, right? And I really do think this is more meant to be Dino De Laurentiis' thing than David Lynch's thing. It was meant to be his prestige piece.
Well, I mean, but there's nothing like Star Wars is a good example. And it's just because they have to create a religion. They have to create a global thing that we have no point of reference on. Right. No, we don't understand their conflict. We don't understand the religion. We don't understand the technology. And there's levity and there's humor and there's darkness and there's lightness. And they, by the end, I understand what the Force is supposed to be. I understand the rebels, and I understand the Empire.
It was also funny just how much George Lucas ripped off the novel. I mean, Matt mentioned the Sarlacc earlier, and there's also a scene where we see the two sons of Arrakis setting, which is Tatooine, right?
Yep.
That famous shot. So, I mean, obviously, this was a very influential science fiction piece to begin with. So,
but again, if you pretended it was a foreign language film and you weren't watching the movie, you were just looking at what was happening. It's neat to look at, but it there's nothing in between. It's as though they saw Star Wars and they're like, we need to have a fight at the beginning. So he fights like a bladed stick for a while. Like this thing, robot comes out of the ceiling and there's like kind of a fighting scene.
That was in the book, if I recall correctly. Matt, I see you want to say something.
Yeah, the upside down steampunk Dalek thingy that he was supposed to be knife fighting. Yeah, and they in the book, the weirding was some kind of psychic thing they were trying to do. In the movie, they thought must have been too complicated for us proles to understand. So they made it some kind of weapon system, and it's unnecessary.
Big blue-eyed man who is supposed to be the Messiah, explain.
All right, so I guess we're done there. Final thoughts. I guess we'll splice Aaron in here. Matt, what do you think?
This thing is a ponderous mess. Go find the Sci-Fi Channel 2002 miniseries Dune and then Children of Dune, which combines Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, and watch both of them. It's a heck of a lot more fun.
And that's interesting because you're talking probably four times longer and it's more enjoyable than this 1 2-hour movie.
Just Dune by itself was fine, and then Children of Dune continues the story. So even the first one by itself is good. It's still better than this. Bah.
That's funny.
I heard in Aaron's defense, and I'm not going to take away her love of Kyle MacLachlan, because Kyle MacLachlan is a national treasure for all the other work he's done. But I don't know. This is David Lynch's worst film. It's just he was really trying to break into the mainstream at the time by doing a blockbuster, and it just didn't work. And the worst part is it didn't really give him an opportunity to explore what he wanted to explore, and that's what makes him great in all of his other films. This is just too big for his interests. So I think that's really what's holding it back. Is had anybody else beside David Lynch directed this, it would have just been this weird forgotten thing. But since he did, it just unfortunately has to occupy the worst David Lynch movie out there.
Don't see this, it's terrible. No, I mean, honestly, there's just
I'm talking to Nick right now internally, and I'm trying to project my thoughts, and I'm telling him to say that it's terrible.
It's just so you have the voice. Have you been trained by the Bene Gesserit?
I walk without rhythm, which is why I don't attract the worm.
This movie is so bad, guys. Like, oh my God. At one point, I was checking the timestamp, and I hit the wrong button and it accidentally fast forward, and for a brief minute of bliss I thought I could let it fast forward.
that's true.
But then I went back and Matt Quinn had checked his phone for a second and looked up, and he didn't recognize what was happening, and he goes, oh, did we skip ahead? And I said, unfortunately no, you just have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, and
I remember hearing there was something about Thufir Hirwat, it was a captive of the Harkonnens being forced to milk a cat.
Sure, that's a thing that happens in this movie.
You see the cat in the cage being carried.
No, I trust you. I trust you.
Well, I was going to give you credit for something, Matt, but I guess we don't have to go there. So with that,
I'll give Matt plenty of credit. He's the only one that actually could tell me what the hell was going on in this movie.
No kidding. So without further ado, we're out of time, guys. Next week is a cartoon week to try to bring joy back to our lives. But the week after, we're entering December, and with December, we're going to have a little bit of some more lighthearted, family-friendly kind of movies, the kinds of things that we saw growing up a lot. And so we're going to see a Gene Wilder musical number, and we're going to leave it at that.
Aww.
So tune in next week and every future week when we put another little piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
So we have a friend who really loved this film. She wanted to be on the panel, but she had to go out of town, and we were not able to record together. Sometimes scheduling is impossible. So here is Aaron's review of the movie. Enjoy.
Okay. people will tell you this is not a good movie. They'll say it's too long, too confusing, too many characters. Those people are wrong. This movie is amazing. For one, it's one of the most quotable movies of all time. If you watch this film and do not walk away talking about The Housekeeper and Into the Desert Like a Wild Ass Go I Forth and How Can This Be? For He Is the Kwisatz Haderach, then you're dead to me. You're dead to me. Pretty much my entire childhood was spent calling my brothers by many of the ridiculous character names in this movie. Thufir Hawat and Gurney Halleck were favorites. And, oh god, Thufir's eyebrows. It's worth seeing if only for Thufir's eyebrows. And Halleck? That's freaking Jean-Luc Picard, people. And if you can't get behind a Patrick Stewart film, then you are likewise dead to me. Dune also has Sting, jumping around near naked and screaming, I will kill you, at National Treasure Kyle MacLachlan. Yes, I said it. National Treasure Kyle MacLachlan. It is nothing short of a travesty that we have not built monuments in honor of that man. He is a legend, a true gift from God. A Kwisatz Haderach, if you will. See what I did there? Yeah. If you can sit through that, you can sit through Dune, my friends. Anyway, I could do this for hours. If I did, my narration would likely culminate in how I want to go balls to the wall as Lady Jessica and have a horde of Fremen riding a sandworm marching next to me in the DragonCon parade. Hashtag life goals. But I'll just conclude with this. Dune is a litmus test of life. The movie is its own Gom Jabbar. You'll want to pull your hand out. You'll think you're being tortured. But keep your hand in the box. Because if you do, you'll come out the other side a godlike figure in my eyes. And you'll be wise enough to know that he who controls the spice controls the universe, and that fear is the mind killer. No lie, I had that written on my bathroom mirror for more than a year. I have to go. Saw too much. Very, very excited. Kyle MacLachlan, National Treasure. I'm out.
So we have a friend who really loved this film. She wanted to be on the panel, but she had to go out of town. And we were not able to record together. Sometimes scheduling is impossible. So here is Aaron's review of the movie. Enjoy.